Good evening, folks. My name is Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic. He's right. Andy and I have made a great team. My sobriety day is March the 7th of 1990. I'll get into that here in a little bit. Deep appreciation to the committee and all the work that goes into this that gets us up here. The speakers really are the light load carriers, really. We just come up here and talk for an hour, and the rest of these folks spend a whole year putting this together. So that's very much appreciated. And when I'm at these events where we have ASL folks, American Sign Language, I always want to point them out. So we got Emily and Lou that are over here signing, and they will be the hardest working people in this room tonight. I will glance over there periodically, because if they get ahead of me, I'll try to catch up. And sometimes, because I know how challenging that is, I may throw out a Comanche word or two just to see how you handle that. I don't know more than that, but it's always interesting, especially if it's a long one. I'm always envious of people who say they came into AA and they sat down and they found a place, they found a home, they knew they belonged here. That was not the way I did it. I've been in AA now for 33 years. I cannot imagine my life without the Alcoholics Anonymous program. And I'll talk about some things probably at the tail end of my story. But I cannot imagine dealing with life on life's terms without the advantage of the Alcoholics Anonymous program. The 12 steps, sponsors, service work, all the other stuff. But I didn't feel that way when I was first introduced to AA in 1975. I was up in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul. Up there they have DWIs. And I'd gotten a DWI, and, excuse me, and it was not a big deal in 1975. It was never a fun experience, but it wasn't the end of the world. And I had friends who had gotten DWIs, so I did what they did. I got an attorney. And I knew that I was going to have to pay him, and he would go to court with me and talk to the judge. I would pay a $300 fine, and I would walk out with a careless driving citation. That's what I expected. I probably drew a judge who was a member of AA. because he said the only way you're going to be able to do that is to go spend a year in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to tell you, I was outraged over that. I thought that represented the grossest miscarriage of justice I had ever seen. I saw absolutely no reason for it. And at that time, the FAA was not cross-checking pilot licenses with DWIs or DUIs. So that was not a factor. And my first reaction was, F that, I'm not doing that. And then I gave it a second thought, and I thought, well, it's not going to really look good, have that on record. So I angrily agreed to do that. And I went to an AA meeting, and I sat down, and I was there 5 minutes. And I looked around, and I took it all in, and I listened to the people talking. And there was absolutely no doubt in my mind that this was an absolute cult. And I'm listening to these people talk, and they're clearly cult members. I'm thinking, you know, these people think if you drink two beers in a week, you're an alcoholic. And I do not want to be here. I don't belong here. So I figured out a way to circumnavigate that whole process, and I did it. I would go into a hotel room on a layover, and before I'd even get out of my uniform, I'd go to pick the phone up, phone book up, look in the yellow pages, and I'd write down the address and phone number of the local AA meeting. I didn't care what city or what town I was in, I did that. And then I would structure a fictional meeting around it. I think I had to make three a week, I think that was what it was. So I'm turning these in. I'm not going to any meetings. Not after that first one. And then I would tell my wife, I'd say, you know, I better go to one a month in case somebody has to say they saw me. I had a really bad attitude. I don't think there's anybody in this room that disliked AA or had more contempt and scorn and disdain for AA people than I did. And I didn't mind letting you know. And so there would be problems in there, and my default we're doing this again. Thank you. Thank you. I don't think this is working. You know, if I didn't pre-flight an airplane before I took off, at any rate, I don't know if you can hear me or not. I'll try this. Can you hear me? Somebody saying yes and somebody saying no.
Less than 20 years.
It's okay. I've got a timer up here and I've only got 2 hours and 27 minutes left. You know, if I didn't know better, I think you're doing that on purpose. Is this an ego thing? You want a little recognition every meeting? At any rate, I'd go to these meetings once a month. And God, I hated them. I would rather somebody pull a fingernail. It was the longest hour of my entire life. And I hated being there in an AA meeting with AA people. I just hated it. And I would come home with smoke coming out of my ears. And I tell my wife, Barbara, that is the most effed up bunch of people I have ever seen. I mean, God almighty, they lose their homes, their cars, their wives, their kids, their jobs. And they sit around, they talk about it for an hour. And I'd say, for God's sake, let's have a drink. And I'd mix the strongest drink I could choke down. Sometimes two of them, just to chill out from my AA meeting. And I held on to that for 15 years until, talk about what we were like, what happened, what we're like now. And, you know, I go to these conferences, and more times than not, the speaker says what it was like. And I don't think that's a big deal, but some people really get upset. And I get a really cryptic email from a guy in Southwest Georgia, and he says, I'm an old-timer. And he said, I'm listening to one of your CDs with some newcomers, and you're misquoting the big book. And I thought, what's he talking about? I don't quote the big book. I mean, I don't have that gift. Some of my friends do. I don't. Although, once in a while, I will reference something in the top paragraph, page 132. I have no idea what it is. I just know you'll go look. But he says, you're saying what it was like. It's what we were like. And I thought, oh, really? Really? So I sent an email and said, well, I'm sorry, I'll try to do better. And apparently it lacked the ring of sincerity that he desired. And I get another email back. And he says, well, it's rather important. He said, if I was sitting on the front row with some of the other old-timers and you started that way, we might just get up and walk out, thinking if you're going to start by misquoting the big book, the rest of the message can't be that good. Well, I no longer had my AA attitude at that point. It kind of tricked my competitive spirit. And so I sent him back another email. I said, well, I don't believe I'd burst into tears if that happened. And I probably wouldn't rush out and get a drink. But I said, I didn't expect this to keep bouncing back and forth, but as long as it has, let me just remind you that when we read How It Works, it doesn't say, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly memorized the book. I didn't get any more emails after that. However, about 3 years later, I went down to Southwest Georgia to speak at the Flint River Roundup, and they had assigned him as my host. He's a really good guy. He's a really good guy. He's passed away since then. But it served its purpose. I've never said what it was like for those who seize up on that. On March the 8th of 1990, I was involved in a situation that had never occurred in this country before, and that is that an airline crew was arrested for having flown from Fargo, North Dakota to the Twin Cities, Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport under the influence of alcohol. I was the captain of that flight. It's interesting today when I see a pilot's picture, TSA's pulling him out because they smell alcohol. He's not in the news cycle on day two. I was the first pilot in American commercial aviation history to be arrested, tried, convicted, sentenced, and sent to federal prison for flying in a commercial airliner under the influence of alcohol. It was a huge media event that stayed on the news forever. I was the lead story nationally and locally for a long time. I thought it would never go away. There were times when I thought, I don't know that Pearl Harbor got this much coverage. And every time it aired, it was a knife right through my heart. Because this isn't who I am. It's never been who I was. It's not the way I live my life. But in one fell swoop, I lost absolutely everything that I'd ever held in value or treasured. I mentioned the DWI and the difference between DWI and DUI. Now I'll talk about my Native American background here in a little bit, but I had a good Indian friend. He's a Hopi. Called him the Happy Hopi, and he's passed away now because of diabetes, which is a plague in the Indian country, as well as alcoholism. But he would talk, and he said, I was in court for my sixth DWI before I learned that that didn't stand for drinking with Indians. You see, I think what we do here tonight, what we did the other night when Steve talked and when Kathy talked, when we laugh like that, that is the most healing and whole and healthy laughter there is. It's not that hide behind defensive laughter, like my wife just left with the kids. Well, we learn to laugh in here, and we learn to laugh at things that other people would never laugh at. But for us, it's cathartic. It's whole, it's healthy, and it's healing. And it's a gift I never thought I would get back. I never thought I'd laugh again. I was detained for 12 hours on the day of the arrest, and it was surreal. I sat there with a lot of people, the other two pilots and lawyers and FAA people, high-level management, Northwest people. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And I felt sometimes like I was suspended, watching this happen to someone else. This could not be happening to me. But it was. And I'd have those gut-grinding moments of reality, and it was all I could do not to throw up and get sick. It was incredible. And I used to spend a lot of time trying to describe to you the level of shame and disgrace and dishonor that went all the way to my bone marrow. And then the big book talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and I don't think it can be said any better than that. It was all that and more. I'd been the guy in my family, my three children were grown and gone. I'd been the guy in my family who waved the flag and held the standard of duty, honor, country. Character, honesty, integrity. Do the right thing. And by virtue of the personal example that I had just set, which was getting ready to get exponentially worse, everything that I told my children, I had made void by my personal example. And it was difficult for me. It's really difficult. We were released late that night. Northwest Airlines was the only major carrier that did not have a program for alcoholic pilots. That program started in 1973. It's been very quiet under the radar. The public didn't know about it. Highly successful. 92% success rate. Not because they're dealing with pilots, but because of the way it's structured and administered. And Northwest had refused to be a part of that airline community. Now, Northwest is not responsible for anything I did, nor are they responsible for me being an alcoholic. But every few years, I had seen some pilot get in difficulty, and I knew what the outcome was. It was swift, it was severe, it was immediate, it was irrevocable. They left, and that explosion of the incident echoed throughout the ranks of the pilots and flight attendants within a day or two. And I had a list of names up here in my hall of shame and the details of their situations. And over the course of that 12 hours, when I had a million things going through my mind, that hit me. That's my legacy. That's where my name goes, and that's how I leave here. And that just added to the shame. I spent a lifetime trying to achieve and accomplish. I had come out of nowhere with nothing, and I climbed the ladder. My goal had always been to be the best, to work the hardest, to do what couldn't be done. And it was all gone. It was all gone. And I couldn't believe the level of disgrace and dishonor that I experienced. Because I'm an alcoholic, something I never thought I would ever be. And I don't have the power to overcome this disease, which is chronic and progressive. And sooner or later, I can't manage it. And I reached that point. I got home the next day, which was March the 9th. My wife picked me up at the airport. I knew I would never wear that uniform ever again. Every time somebody glanced my way as I walked through the airport, I felt like I was taking a blow that they were soon going to know. And I got in the car. And I never told a story without saying I felt like I had to climb over the curb to get in the car with her. We've been married a long time, and I couldn't look at her. And all I could say is, honey, I'm so sorry. She's got a soft South Texas accent. She pulled away from the curb and she said, who better than I might possibly know how you feel right now? We drove home in silence, which was a gift. I didn't want to talk about this. I was absolutely sick at heart. She went to work. I went inside the house. Did not want to be in my skin. And a few minutes later, I called a PhD doctor, who will get in the story here in a little bit. And I said, I need to declare an emergency. I need to see you right away. He said, I'll clear the calendar, come straight over. So I did. And when I tell this story, it's like a video is in my brain. It's a movie that I'm seeing right now. I still remember the color of the walls in his office. I remember the layout, the French door that was there, his desk. I'm going to hear two comments on this particular day, March the 9th, that I cannot respond to. And I walked in and I told him straight out what had happened. I was done. I was beat. I was broken. I was destroyed. I was devastated. So I didn't play around with any cutesy minimizing or words. I just told him straight out. And he looked at me and said, God, wow. He said, this is horrible. He said, this is absolutely horrible. He started around his desk and he stopped and he looked at me, turned to the left, and I heard the first comment that I could not respond to because he said, maybe this is what had to happen. I had no earthly idea what that meant or why he would say it to me. It had nothing to do with anything that had transpired between him and me up to that point. He came back and he said, I've got a doctor's appointment set up tonight across Atlanta. Very prominent psychiatrist who is also a recovering alcoholic cocaine addict. He's certified in addiction medicine, which I had never even heard of. I picked up on the 6 o'clock appointment time, though. I know doctors don't see patients at 6 o'clock Friday nights, and I knew that they conveyed a certain sense of urgency. Later, he told me, based on your appearance, he said, I was so afraid you were a suicide, and it was imperative that you go see this man right away. So Barbara and I drove over there. I hadn't had anything to eat or drink for 2 days. But the whole meeting was just like an alcoholic blackout. I'm a blackout drinker. Not always. Sometimes it's a partial blackout. But, well, you know, we get pretty good detectives. I mean, I don't want to transgress off of the story here, but I mean, I'd have evenings where I would say something to my wife, and the last thing I wanted her to say to me was, you don't remember, do you? I said, sure, I remember. So I would throw out a little comment, and I would wait for the response. And then I'd wait a little while, and I'd say something else. And pretty soon, I could piece this pretty much together. I was a pretty good detective at that. But I had no memory of that meeting. And I was stone cold sober. I remember parts of it. I don't know how long he talked to me. I'm sure he took a history like they all do, family history and everything else. What I remember is he looked at me and he said, Lolly, he said, you're an alcoholic. You need to get into treatment tonight. And I had no reaction to that. Now, I've always had a reaction. I've hated alcoholics. My parents died from this disease. I got 2 suicides in my family. I've seen the alcoholics. I saw them in my native community. I saw them around the cities that I flew in. Passed out in the doorways or the park grass or on a bench. Those are alcoholics. I'm not one. But in the 24 hours since the arrest, I knew. I will never know how I knew, but I knew. And I looked at him and I said, I thought you would probably tell me that, and I'm okay. And I said, I just got home today. I said, please let me go home. I said, I'd like for Barbara just to hang on to me. I said, let my mind uncoil. Let me absorb what's happened to me. And then I'll go into treatment. He said, you need to go into treatment tonight. I took a breath and I said, okay. So we drove back across Atlanta and I went into a treatment facility with the clothes on my back. There was a sign there at the corner. There's still a sign. It's a different sign. Still the same location. I hit the brakes. My light's directly on that sign. It said, out. Anchor Hospital. Hospital for alcoholism and other chemical dependencies. And I hit the brakes and stopped. The light's on the sign from me to the front row here. And I thought, my God Almighty, my life ends tonight in a treatment center for alcoholics. And all I could do is think, what happened? And I had a little quick mini flashback over the events in my life that I was extraordinarily proud of. Trophy moments. Things that I had achieved and acquired. These things gave me meaning and purpose and definition. And I felt like there was a giant eraser that had wiped them all out. In that moment, I wasn't even sure if they were real. We started down the hill into the treatment center. And for the first time that day, I thought, oh my God, this is March the 9th. Today is my 27th wedding anniversary. And I said to Barbara, hell of a way to spend an anniversary, huh? I then heard the second statement that I could not process because very softly she said, might be the best one we ever had. I thought, who could think that? My life is over. It's done. There wasn't an ounce of hope that there could be a positive outcome to this. All the other incidents involving the pilots that I was aware of, none of them had been able to come back. And their situation wasn't even 10% as bad as mine was and was going to get. So I knew it was over. I would never fly again. I had no idea. My life was just over. I mentioned it was mine, 27th wedding anniversary. A few years back, March the 9th rolled around, and one of my sponsees pulled up the driveway. Surprised her. He said, I've heard stories March the 9th. Thought I'd surprise you and Barbara and come by and wish you a happy anniversary. So he came in and was having some coffee. So he asked us, he said, what's the secret for having stayed married so long? And before I had a chance to say anything, Barbara said, I think it's basically because I could just never stand to admit that I'd made a mistake. We try to get rid of our character defects. I keep feeding her, so I want that to remain. And as we stand here tonight, she and I have been married now over 60 years. I'll go back and fill in some of the blanks. Tell you that I was born in Wichita, Kansas, September the 29th, 1938. So I got number 85 coming up here pretty quick. Don't feel it, and never have felt it. I sometimes let things get a little out of control and say, I've still got all my own parts, they all work. And Barbara's on the front row, I have to qualify that with most of the time. She's not here tonight. I grew up in a World War II housing project on the edge of Wichita called Plainview. Not a very pretty place. It's supposed to be temporary housing for World War II. It's still there. It's an economically deprived area. Yet my most favorite childhood memories are of growing up in Plainview, because we were all the same. It's a diverse community. Blacks, whites, Hispanics, small Native American segment as part of the Native American segment, an ethnic mix of several different things, but the two that really respond to the alcohol are the Irish and Comanche parts. And so I usually have a pretty entertaining evening when I'm going out. I either will find a place that has that live Irish music, or I just want to go out and kill some white people. I grew up in my native community. My native culture is the strongest part of my identity. I was active in the powwows. I was a dancer. I knew the songs, the etiquette, a little bit of the language, not much. But that was a very strong part of who I was. It was also a part that I shamed during this whole incident. But because of my appearance, they never picked up on that. The news never picked up on that. I graduated from high school. Let me go back. When I was 14, the alcohol had really done its job with my parents. I'm fortunate that I never was a product of domestic violence. There was none of that. I never had to interfere with my dad beating my mom. There was a lot of screaming and yelling. But it was an alcoholic home where I never knew what was going to happen next. I could never take friends over because I didn't know who was going to be drunk or how drunk they were going to be or how embarrassing it was going to be. So they divorced when I was 14, and in the next 2 years, 3 years, each of them had been married two more times in divorce. So I was a product of a lot of blended families bouncing back and forth, and I didn't do well in those families. I clashed and conflicted. And I don't remember. I often wonder, if one of those stepbrothers or stepsisters ever walked in the room, I wouldn't know who they were. So I kind of finished my high school situation as a nomad, going back and forth. I graduated when I was 17, and not too many went to college from where I came from. Some did. I had decided I was going to join the service, didn't know what. About that time, one of my friends came back from the Marine Corps, right out of boot camp, and I was pretty impressed with his appearance. We sat for one afternoon drinking beer, and he regaled me with nonstop stories of what Marine drill instructors do to their recruits. I had just turned 18, and it was probably the early indication that my thinking wasn't quite right, because I thought, man, I just can't wait to go do that. And off I went. You know, we hear a lot of speakers. I never fit in. That's a theme around here, and I hear it, and I understand it, and I believe it. That was not my story. When I got to Marine Corps boot camp, once I got over the shock of it, the initial shock, I thought, oh my God, I have really screwed the pooch. Now, this is the worst decision I ever made. Once I got over that and I snapped into it, I fit. I never had an experience like that before since. And it was an extraordinarily extreme, demanding, intense experience. And I mean no disrespect to the other services. But Marine Corps boot camp is not like those. It is not. It's just a fact. And I settled into it. And because the thing that captured me more than anything else was something I'd never seen before. And that is that sense of brotherhood, that esprit de corps, that sense of belonging, that inextricable tight binding of one Marine to the next. And that captured me. And I thought, I love this. This is where I belong. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to stay here. I just wanted to survive the 13 weeks, which was a real test. And at the end of the 13 weeks, they called out three names of the three top guys. My name was the second one called. I was shocked, I was surprised, and I was extraordinarily proud. And I got that one private first class stripe. You don't run the Marine Corps, it's a PFC. But all my buddies had slick sleeves, and I got that red bordered stripe, and I could not take my eyes off of that. I had never achieved or accomplished anything like that, especially under those conditions. My next promotion, the last corporal, was meritorious as well. I was a good Marine. I'm drinking, and I'm not going to have time for a big, long drunkalogue here. I've got one. But I can either talk about the good parts of the story, the recovery part, or the drunkalogue. And you've all heard drunkalogues, and mine will parallel the rest of it. I got the two DWIs. I got in fights in bars. I woke up in places I didn't know where I was. I didn't lost cars twice. I had no idea where they were in the entire city. So I had all of these adventures, but I blew it off. I just go, it can happen. My mantra was, that can happen to anybody. And if I took those situations individually, that could probably be true. But when I got in treatment and I had two or three pages of those things, I go, that can't all be good. At any rate, I'm drinking hard all the way, but I'm with people who are drinking hard too. I'm a young Marine. I'm supposed to be able to play hard. I'm supposed to be a tough guy. Play hard, drink hard. 4.5 years later, my commanding officer took me into his office, and he said, there's a new program out called Marine Aviation Cadet. He said, you're the only guy in the unit whose entry score, which was that time was called a GCT score, is high enough to test for that program if you want to test for it. I knew I had a high score. I don't know quite how it got there, but I knew it was there. And I wanted to test. I went over, it was an all-day test, and I passed. He said, what you need to know is this is an 18-month program, and on average, plus or minus, half don't make it. The other thing you need to know is you're coming in the back door as an enlisted Marine who took a test. He said 98-99% of the other people coming in from the civilian side have to have 2 years college minimum, and most will have more than that, and you will be in that program with those people. Now, I could put two and two together. I knew that if half don't make it, and I'm starting off way behind educationally with no college, that I stand a good chance of not making it. But I want to try. I went home to Wichita. There was a powwow going on. They knew I told them I was going to Pensacola the next day. They called for a special for me. It's an honoring dance. And I went out and led the dance. And for the next 18 months, I remembered that dance. And I was driven with the idea that I cannot return to this native community as a failure. None of them have the opportunity laid before me. And if I'm successful, I'll get a pair of gold wings, just like these right here on my lapel. I'm going to get two gold bars. I'm going to be a commissioned Marine Corps officer. What an opportunity. I cannot fail. And so I'm driven with that for 18 months. There were four phases of flight training. In every one of those phases, I was right at the top, the number two guy. And I never expected that. And every time it happened, I was surprised. I didn't believe I was doing as well as my flight grades indicated. I'm watching my friends wash out weekly, sometimes daily. I watch them leave with their hearts broken. They want those wings as much as I do. But for some reason, they're not going to do it. They're not going to be able to do it. They're washing out. And every time one of them walks away with a sea bag over his shoulder, I'm thinking, before this is over, that will be me. And I continue to work hard. I talk about my parents. I never go to the podium without thanking my parents for the really good stuff that they gave me before the alcohol killed them. And one of them is a work ethic. I will do whatever I have to do to get the job done. I'll get dirty, hot, sweaty, greasy. I don't care. I will work as hard as I have to get the job done. And I took that with me into flight training. The last 6 months of flight training, I leave Pensacola and I go to Texas, Beeville, Texas, for advanced jet flight training. 6 months to go. If I can make it, then I get the wings and the commission. I'm drinking. My cadet buddies and I drink like crazy. I mean, we drink every weekend like our hair's on fire. We make less money than any one of the other groups that are involved in the flying training, and we party harder than any of them. But on Sunday, I shut it down because I want to study. I've got a week of flying coming up, and I want to be ready for it. I could do that at that point in time. The big book says we could. At some point in time, we could manage to drink. I couldn't do it later. We get into Beeville, Texas on a Friday night. I hook up with my buddies. We go to the officers' club and get drunk. They want to go to a drive-in in the small town of Beeville. Well, that's where the good-looking Texas girls hang out. I go with them. And they immediately go after a carload of girls. I kind of hang back. I'm not that gutsy. I need some more to drink. And I don't see the driver. She's at an angle. I can't really tell much about her. But I drink enough, and I rehearse some stuff, and I think, okay, I'm ready. And I got some stuff that's way above my norm. When I go up there, I'm thinking, God, I got some good stuff. She may just take her clothes off sitting there. So I go up there, and she turns and looks, and she is pretty. And everything vacates. And I got nothing. And I'm supposed to say something, and I have not been practicing talking. Been doing a lot of drinking, but not much talking. And I see these beautiful brown eyes and that pretty face. And I said something like, it was so bad, I didn't even know what I said. And she looked at me like I just stood there and peed on the side of her car. And I turned around, I left, I walked away. I go, that's embarrassing, I'm not going back. A little while later, a few minutes later, she gets out and walks in the car. And I got a good look at her. She had turquoise shorts on. She had a cute little butt. She had pretty legs. And I'm part, like I could see her walking right down that aisle. And I had an AA thought. I didn't know it was an AA thought. I recognized it 29 years later. But she's walking down there, and I'm thinking, my God Almighty, I want what she has, and I'm willing to go to anyone to get it. So I had a chance encounter with her the next day. She had a girlfriend, had a buddy with me, and when I saw her go in, skidded the car into the parking lot, walked in, and surprised. She let me buy her a cup of coffee and told me her name was Barbara. And Barbara pinned my wings on me on February 25th, 1963, which was her 20th birthday. We went home to Kansas for a three-week leave, much deserved rest. She stayed with my sister. I stayed with my dad, who was drinking really badly, really bad. And I was getting ready, it was coming to an end. I said, you're going back to Texas. I've got orders to California. I said, let's get married. We ran down to a small town, Newkirk, Oklahoma, stood in front of a justice of peace with a couple from high school who took their rings off and loaned them to us so we could do the ceremony. And that's how we got married. She was the youngest wife in the Marine Corps squadron I was in, barely 20 years old, immediately pregnant, which I thought was part of my Marine Corps obligation. And we had two little boys, 8 days less than a year apart. No, we're not Catholics. We're just horny Protestants. And we became the first. It was a wonderful life. I had this gorgeous gal that thought I was okay, and I'm burning up the skies at night in jet fighters. It was a kid's dream. My dream had come true. And I'm with 28 of the finest men, the finest officers, and the best pilots that I'll ever see in my lifetime. And we go to Vietnam. We were one of the first jet squadrons into Vietnam. I've got a very shiny military resume. Sandy Beach was a good friend of mine. And his story with regard to the military and mine are completely opposite. I've been so grateful that by the time my alcoholism really manifested itself, it didn't do it while I was in the service. That I have these wonderful memories and these comrades that I fought in the war with and flew with. And I got through that really well. I finally decided to get out of the Marine Corps. I'd gotten a regular commission. Not possible. They want their officers with regular commissions, which guarantees an officer a career, to have a college degree, or awfully close to it. I had zero college. And these commissions were highly competitive, and I got one. And that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm not supposed to go into a bar in Fargo, North Dakota, and become the greatest pariah in all of American commercial aviation history. No pilot, before or since, has done the damage that I did to an airline or to a profession. And I'm not happy about that, but I own it. It's mine, and I will live with it. And I hope I've made some kind of recompense in the years since then. But I got out of the Marine Corps, and 3 weeks later I was in class at Northwest Airlines. And for nearly 22 years I had the same kind of career there. Loved going to work. I loved the flying. I loved the people I flew with, both in the front and the back. Great job. Couldn't wait to go to work. We get there and Barbara wants a daughter. We decide to adopt. It's tough. We had two biological kids. And we fought for 14 months, and we bring this little Indian girl home. Her name was Dawn. She was 17 days old when she came to live in my house. And I quickly found out what daughters do to their dads. She became the center of my universe. God, I love that little girl. And when she was 17, she ran away from home. I didn't see it coming. Barbara didn't see it coming. I don't know if I hadn't been drinking, if I would have or not. I don't deny it. I just don't know. The problem with me and convincing me that I was an alcoholic, I didn't drink every night. I only drank 3 mornings in the year, 4th of July, Labor Day, Memorial Day. And I knew all alcoholics drank in the morning. I'd seen it on TV and in the movies. I had all these arguments about why I couldn't be an alcoholic. I didn't beat or abuse my wife or kids. I wasn't the guy that was having divorces, marrying one flight attendant after another. I wasn't the guy that was having trouble with check rides. I didn't think I had a problem. But that's the power of this disease in our brain. So, oh, here we are again. Would you buy these things on eBay or what? You know, if I was going to get brain surgery, I wouldn't shop for the cheapest doctor. Steve, you only had to deal with this one time.
We thank you for your support.
Okay. Tell you what. If you got a megaphone, I'll just use a megaphone. At any rate, I didn't handle that very well. I put off being a captain for 2 years because I wanted to be home with my daughter until she graduated high school. That was a sacrifice for me. Everybody in my class said, "You'll be the first guy to check out." I said, "You better believe it." And I passed it up for 2 years because I wanted to be home with my little girl. She's coming up on graduation, and I go to Chicago to take a special written test so I can be a captain. The afternoon that Barbara drove me to the airport so I could go to Chicago, Dawn and some of her friends got what she wanted and left a note. And Barbara found it late that night, couldn't call me. Found out about it the next day when I was getting ready to come home. And I blurted out where to go, who to call, where to look. I was panicked. I was scared. My little girl is gone. I have no idea what's happening to her. It's a two-hour flight from Chicago back to Atlanta, and I don't know what happened to me, but something did. Because when I got off the airplane, I hated her. I don't know how that happened or why it happened. I just know it happened. And when I got off the airplane, I hated her worse than I thought I could hate anyone in my entire life. And I told Barbara, I said, "I don't care if she dies in the streets." I said, "She will never come back to my home to live. And I never want her name mentioned in my presence for the rest of my life." And I told the rest of the family that, along with friends. Within 2 days, all of her furniture was gone. There's no physical trace she'd ever even been in my home. I went to the bank and I ripped up her adoption papers. I went to an attorney and I gave him $500 and disowned her. I tried to annul the adoption and I couldn't. And in a way that's only insanely amusing, like most alcoholics will understand, as I assessed this problem and looked at it, I thought, Barbara doesn't seem to be handling this too well. She probably needs a therapist. And I got into Yellow Pages, and by the luck of the draw, I got a PhD family therapist. We saw him twice a month for almost 2 years, and he was very good. I didn't like talking about my daughter. One time when he was trying to get me to talk about her, I made a statement that I had never consciously ever thought of or formed. And I said, "I'm going to tell you something, doctor." I said, "I would rather hate than hurt." And he said, "You survived a childhood doing that, and if you continue, it'll destroy you." And he was right. And it wasn't until I got into treatment that I saw that. I did not know that. But what I did, anytime there was a risk of pain or vulnerability in a relationship or anything, I call up the anger. And when I do that, the walls come up and they're high enough and thick enough that pain cannot penetrate. And it worked for me, I thought. But I lost all of that when I went into treatment. And the alcohol, ironically, quit working for me. I didn't want to go out to cruise anymore. I don't want to go out and have dinner. I know where every liquor store is. In every city and town we lay over, I know exactly how long it takes me to change clothes, get there, get a quart of booze, and get home, get back. I know every one of them in every city we go into. And that's what I do. And I come back and I lock the door and I turn the TV on. I don't go to the phone if they call. A crew member calls. I don't answer the door if a crew member knocks. I don't want to be bothered. I want to drink. That's all I want to do is just drink. And I throw the booze down. I drink stiff stuff. I don't like it straight, but I drink it awfully strong. And I never got that ease and comfort, that feeling that I don't even have to talk about with you guys. You know exactly what I'm talking about. It never returned. Instead, what I got, when I threw the booze down, it's like a gasoline hitting a fire in my belly. And boom, up came the hatred, the bitterness, the self-pity, the martyrdom, this long list of things I had done for this little girl. And look how she had repaid me. And I get to the end of the bottle and I'm wasted emotionally. I am tired. I'm exhausted. And the next night I do it again and again and again and again. And it never worked. I never got the relief. That's where we were when I was arrested. I go into this treatment center and within a week, it's all over. Well, it's all over TV and about day two. I don't want anybody to know who I am. And now they all know. It's a week before anybody knew the color of my eyes, because I can't look up. I'm so ashamed. At the end of the first week, it was announced on TV that Northwest Airlines had terminated me, as they should have. The FAA had issued an emergency revocation of all my flight certificates, which was fair, and I lost my FAA medical certificate because of my alcoholism. So I'm stripped, and I don't have an education. I've got nothing to fall back on. And I'm done. I'm done. By that time, I go into a group therapy room to talk. They close the door. Talking is counterintuitive to me. But I, for some reason, I start talking about my daughter. And I don't have that wall of anger up there. And I break down and cry. I hadn't cried at my parents' funerals. I did not cry. And I sobbed in that group with 8 or 10 people watching me. Because my heart was breaking. And for the first time, I'm starting to recapture some feelings that God gave me when I came out of the womb and I had shut down a long time ago. And I got a hold of Barbara and said, "Let's put the family back together again. No visitors, no phone calls, this treatment center." They said, "We'll give you a day room if you can make that happen. That's such an impossible breakthrough for you." So some days later, I walked in. The two doctors said, "Could we please come watch this?" And they were off to the left. I walked in this room. My two sons were there. Barbara was there. I saw my little girl for the first time in 2 years. She had a little baby in her arms, a granddaughter. She got married. I didn't even know her last name. Already things were starting to happen for me because of what was happening. As this is a 12-step treatment center. This is all about AA. Throughout the course of the rest of my stay there, they're having to come tell me the latest legal developments, which they're loath to do, but they've got to tell me. When I go through 6 legal crises, Minnesota indicts me. 90 days misdemeanor. I can't believe that I can serve 90 days in a jail. I've never been locked up. The only time I would be locked up is as a POW in Vietnam if I shot down. North Dakota indicts me. It bounces back and forth. They double the penalties. They're coming to take me out of groups every 2 or 3 days, and every time they walk in, I just seize. And they go, and I don't want to go. And they give me the latest bad news. It's like they suck the air out of the room and I can't breathe. And finally they take me out, take me down to a doctor's office and said, federal grand jury's just indicted you. You're looking at 15 years in federal prison, a $250,000 fine, and an attorney's coming in Sunday wants $50,000. We went broke in 30 days, didn't have it. The doctor says, I got to ask you, you're going to hurt yourself. I said, no. I went back to my room, like every nerve in my body was numb. 15 years. And I collapsed in the room, and I cried for the second time. My head resting on the side of the carpet, and all I could say was, God, I can't do this anymore. I've got nothing left, not even for one more time. Please, not even one more time. Please help me. I had life-changing experiences in treatment because I was in there for the right reason. What I could never have heard 15 years earlier, and all of the thoughts and the ideas I had about AA and the people in it were wrong. And so now I'm listening. I can't sleep at night, and I'm processing everything that I've heard that day, both from counselors and doctors and fellow patients. And I know who I am. I know what I have got. I understand this. I surrender. I quit. I believe. I just hope this works when I leave treatment, and it does. I got out of treatment, and I was heavily publicized three-week trial. We drew the toughest judge in the Minnesota Federal District who had strong feelings about this case, and they were warranted. I didn't begrudge him those feelings. He was entitled to those. I had an advantage over the other two guys, though, because I'm the alcoholic. And if I'm not involved in some kind of legal planning or strategy that night, I go to a meeting. And it's scary because I walk into the room and they know who I am. I'm all over TV. And I never share in the meetings, but I sit and I listen. And there's power in these rooms. And it's in the air. And I breathe it in and I can feel it. And I take it to the courtroom the next day, where they are portraying me as the most worthless piece of crap on the face of the planet. And I can't, and the tabloids are picking it up. Jay Leno's making a monologue living off of me. All the other late night comics. It's in all the tabloids telling everybody what I thought and why I did it and everything else. And I can't respond. Sometimes I look across the courtroom and I see Barbara. And she would mouth the words, I love you. And I would be okay. I would just nod and I'd be okay. Had an amazing story. In the time that I'm up here, you're going to hear about 30% of this whole story. We came back. I told my attorney, I said, I'm going to be found guilty, and when I am, I want you to know I'll be okay. I wanted to plead guilty, and he talked me out of it for reasons that made some legal sense. He said, when you plead not guilty, you're not saying I didn't do it. You're just exercising a constitutional right to have your accuser bring the proof forward. I said, okay. I said, but I'll be found guilty. I'm the captain. Everything comes to me first. Jury goes out, comes right back in. I know what that probably means. I stand. My attorney's on the right. Guilty. And I see him flinch. I reached over and patted him. I said, it's okay. It's okay. We come back a month later for the sentencing. Sentencing guidelines are 12 to 18 months. I know I'm going to get 18 months. I'm the captain. Day and a half before that, my attorney calls me. He said, the judge has just notified everyone, including the media, he's going to depart upwards from the guidelines, and he can go all the way to 15 years. So I go through this exercise in absolute horror, terror that goes all the way to my bone marrow. I tell Barbara, step one, I'm powerless. It's the serenity prayer that I have used over and over and over. I must accept the things I cannot change. And we go in there, and he lectures about what's getting ready to happen. I'm the first to stand, and I don't even know what I'm going to say because I'm so scared. I talked about being grateful to be sober, for the things that had happened inside my family, that I had accepted responsibility for this from day one. I had never tried to evade it or avoid it, and I couldn't change anything. He announces a sentence on me of 16 months, 2 months less, under the guidelines, which blew everyone in the courtroom away. My attorney at first thought he had said 60 months, which got my attention, and he had said 16, and I knew that a miracle had happened. I have had judges, I was a federal judge in treatment. He said, never happens. He said, when you come through the door, he said, the sentence is set. He said, you'll talk, your attorney will talk, maybe you have witnesses. He said, that is a charade, and we do not change from the bench. And there have been judges in audiences around the country who said, that's so, that is true. So I knew that whatever it was going to be was going to be. There was not going to be any last-minute appeal to this. And I knew that a miracle had happened that morning in the courtroom. I thought, I'll never know what, why, or how. 2 years later, a year after I got out of prison, my attorney was in the chambers with the judge. He said, I was going to sentence Lyle to 4 years in prison that morning, and I changed from the bench. He said, I thought about him as a human being, what he said about his time in Vietnam, and I came down. The other two guys to this day do not know that they were headed for 3 years because I got 25% more than they did. To this day, they don't know that story. The judge then said, I'm going to allow you three men. And I'd give Barbara my personal facts. I said, I don't think I'll be coming back. I'll be led away for the cameras. He said, I'm going to let you three men remain free until your appeals are exhausted because this is a heavily complex case and the law was not specifically written for pilots. The other two said, okay. I said, no, I'll go now. Why? Because we deal with life on life's terms in here. I told my kids, I said, I'm terrified. I've never been in a federal prison before. But the truth is I can't come out the back door till I go in the front. And I'm going in the front. I knew I could stay out for a year, year and a half. But every night when that sun went down, I'm one day closer to what's eventually going to happen. And I remembered something from high school English. Somebody then later told me it was Shakespeare. I don't remember that. Said, a coward dies 1,000 deaths, a brave man only one. And I'm not going to die 1,000 more deaths. I'm going to do it, and I'm going to get it over. I also told my kids, you know, courage is not the absence of fear. It's the ability to continue in the face of it. My job now is to walk in that front door. And so I did. On December the 5th, 1990, I became inmate 044-78-041. 34 years to the day that I entered Marine Corps boot camp, I became a federal prison inmate. I served 424 days in the federal prison system. I said that one time, and some guy from the audience comes up, and he said, 424 days? And I said, yeah. He said, man, that's nothing. He said, I was out there 18 years. And I just looked at him and grinned. I said, well, you win. That was a long time for me. Additionally, the judge put sanctions on me to make sure that I never flew again. I was the most horrific, an example of the most horrific betrayal of public trust that had ever occurred. And I was never to see the inside of an airplane ever again. And the judge made sure of that. And another story that I don't have time for. A year after I got out of prison, he lifted the sanctions. Not one chance in 10,000 he would do it, but he did. The FAA then said, if you want to fly again, you'll start with a private license. None of my I'd come out of the Marine Corps. I'd been given a commercial license with an instrument rate. Not one of my fellow pilots thought it was possible to go back and get four licenses, literally from the ground up. And I didn't think so either. And I didn't have any quick fixes. I didn't have any, nothing but hard work. And I'd passed the writtens on all four in 10.5 months. That's a short version of a long story. But there's a flying part that goes with that, and I can't do it. I'm back working at the treatment center that saved my life. I'm working for Anchor Hospital in the counseling department. You know what I'm making? $14,000 a year. And I'm grateful for that job. And I'm taking urine specimens from patients. That's not what an airline captain does. It's what I did. And I did it with a great attitude, because every time I took them, I thought, I'm going to bag them and tag them better than they've ever been done before. But I can't do the flying, not on $14,000 a year. It's going to cost $10,000 or so. By that time, I get a call from and a letter from a friend in Northwest. He said, I have a place up here 50 miles northwest of the Twin Cities. It's got a flight school. I want you to come up and go through my flight school free and live with me and my family. So I went up there and did that. I was up there 44 days, rained out 14 days. I never slowed down. I never quit studying. I never quit working. Flew 78 hours in 30 days. That's a lot of flying in a little airplane. Here's what I don't like about the first person story. You hear I, me. It has to be done that way in order to tell a story. But it's not about I or me. This is about the things that you showed me how to do. One day at a time, one step at a time, one thing at a time, one license at a time, one flight at a time. And that's exactly how I did it. I get no credit for this story. I just followed instructions. I'll take credit for showing up. I'll take credit for staying here. And that's a gift. I came back with 4 licenses. And I told Barbara, I said, I'll never fly on American soil again. Not with my publicity. Alcoholic in the headlines. I can spell anonymity and pronounce it. I never had any. A month later, the licenses came in the mail, and I get a phone call from the pilot. He was head of the pilot unit. Grievance had been automatically filed. I had not activated it, nor was I going to, because Northwest Airlines was 100% justified in terminating me. And I knew that. He said, this is the best phone call I've ever made, because he said 3 hours ago, John Dasburg, president CEO of Northwest Airlines, made a personal decision to bring you back and put you in full flight status at Northwest. I sat there with tears streaming. I couldn't believe the words coming through the phone. If a pilot's airline is mentioned one time publicly, he's done. My airline had been the target of monologues dozens of times, egregiously dragged through the mud. And this man is going to bring me back and let me fly again. And I thought, does he realize that if I come back and relapse, the board of directors will not tolerate that? Not a second time. He'll lose his job. He's gambling his career on my sobriety. Why would he do that? And I went back, and I had meetings with that man once a year, and we talked a lot about this stuff. I never got a good answer to that. Then add into the equation the fact that his father was an alcoholic who never stayed sober. Why would he take a chance on me? But he did. And I went back, never to be a captain again. That was part of the agreement. I said, that's okay, I've been a captain. And now Northwest has a program for pilots, and I'm part of it. As I'm coming up on my last year at Northwest, speaking at United Airlines, I get a phone call. He said, John Dasburg has just changed your back-to-work agreement. He knows you're coming up on your last year, and he thinks for your last year you should be a 747 captain. So I did that. My first day in treatment, I listened to him read the promises. My head was down, my eyes were down, and I perked up a little bit. I thought, I wonder if there's something to this. And I was listening, and then they got that part. No matter how far down the scale we've gone, I thought, no, that's it. That's it. It might work for her, and it might work for him, but I'm going way too far down. And I'm telling you right now, you've heard about 30% of the miracles that I've gotten to live out. I am retired 1998 with a better reputation than I've ever had. I have a huge framed 747 picture on my wall, and there must be 2,000 or 3,000 signatures from my fellow pilots and best wishes. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. Within a day of my retirement, I got a phone call from my attorney. This is 8 years after the trial. And he said, Judge Rosenbaum, chief judge now, the Minnesota Federal District, told me that in 16 years on the federal bench, he has never supported a petition for pardon, but he'll support yours if you want to make the attempt. I had never considered such a thing. The judge came to me. I did not go to the judge. He wrote an affidavit. It's 3 pages that is so chokingly powerful that if I had to read it to you, I'd have tears in my eyes by page 3. 2 years later, I came walking in, and there were 8 phone messages telling me President Bill Clinton had just given me a presidential pardon. For those of you who have tried to get a pardon, getting a pardon from the governor of a state is almost impossible. Getting a pardon from the president is 10 times more so, and it hangs on my wall. Full and unconditional pardon to Norman Lyle Price. Those are the miracles. Kathy mentioned Thursday night, life is in session. My version of that is life happens. And 2 years ago, I get a phone call from a neurologist. And he said, I have to tell you that Barbara's spinal fluid is positive for Alzheimer's. And my world just crashed. And she came in. I'm on the phone, and I have to tell her. And she doesn't say anything, but I see tears going down her cheeks. I put my arms around her. She said, I just hope this isn't something I pass to our children. She's always thinking, for 60 years, she's always felt this way. Somebody else comes first. And I said, honey, I said, I'd give anything if it was me instead of you. And she pulled into me real tight, and she said, oh, no. She said, you'll be able to get along without me, but I could never get along without you. The next day, I was in an AA meeting. And I said, I don't know how many people I've seen relapse. 500? More? I said, they relapse because they break a fingernail. They relapse because they walked out in a flat tire. They relapse because their boss said something bad to them. I said, there's an unending list of reasons to relapse. But once you come here, and once you engage, you will never have an excuse to relapse. I said, There's a story in our book that says nothing, absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake. I believe that. I don't believe that that means that everything that happens in God's world is self-directed by God. I don't believe that. You can believe whatever you want to. I don't believe that. If I believe that, my reaction would not be good. I see people blame God for things that happen. We live here in a complex world, made more complex by free will. We poison the land, the air, and the water. We eat stuff that's not good for us. We chase the almighty dollar. We don't live the way we're supposed to. Genes change, cells change, things mutate, diseases come. Friends who are in love fall out of love and get horrible divorces. Friends that we know are dying in tragic accidents, and loved ones come down with diseases. Every prayer that I start starts with the word Father. If I thought there was a Father that was up there that was so cruel that he would inflict an innocent little baby with a disease just so the parents could suffer, or if he looked down there and said, there's that beautiful Barbara Prowse, one of the kindest, gentlest, sweetest spirits I've ever seen, who in 60 years of marriage that I've known her has never hurt or harmed another human soul. I think I'll throw a little Alzheimer's her way. If I thought that, I could never utter another prayer. And not only that, God would become my problem and thus can never be my solution. I think God's there. I think God cried, just as I did, when I had to tell Barbara. I think he had tears in his eyes. So we will deal with this on life's terms. We're doing some things to fight it. I don't know if we'll win or lose, but we will accept the outcome. And one thing I won't do is sit and do nothing. She was supposed to be here tonight, and then the Alzheimer's kicked in. She was all dressed up, dolled up. She's a good-looking gal. She's 80 years old, and she's really pretty. And I came out of the shower, and she's in her pajamas. It's an Alzheimer's moment, so she's not here. I'm so grateful that she was there 33 years ago when I burned my life to the ground, and she never flinched, and that I am here for her now, sober, 100% available, emotionally, physically, mentally, spiritually. Thanks to God, thanks to AA 12 steps, this higher power that we get introduced to. I'm so far away from that 1975 AA experience. And I'm blessed to be a member of this fellowship. I really am. I want to close with something. I do not wish you joys without a sorrow, nor endless day without the healing dark, nor brilliant sun without the restful shadow, nor tides that never turn against your bark. I wish you faith and strength and love and wisdom and goods, gold enough to help some needy one. I wish you songs, but also blessed silence and God's sweet peace when every day is done. My Comanche name is Yetzidenap. But you know me as Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank you for letting me share with you.